Okay, so I think we're ready to start. I can't actually see you guys. We've got a screen in the Shrine Room, but if we were to have the screen on, because we're recording this on YouTube as well, it would mean that we'd have to have the speaker view on the screen. So I'd just be looking at a picture of myself giving a talk, which is thoroughly disturbing. So instead, we've got the screen off with a blanket over it, but I'm trusting you're there, and Arvid's telling me that you're all there. So good to have you back in the Shrine Room for this first talk. Well, it's not really a talk. So what I propose to do this morning is just to give a sketch of Dada Rinpoche's life. It's not a talk in the sense that there'll be a lot of Dharmic content, and it's something that we will go on to study in the groups. That's not the purpose. So the purpose is just to give more of a sketch of Dada Rinpoche's life, and to carry on evoking his presence. So last night, I thought it was a brilliant idea of Vidyadharka's to show that video of Bhante inaugurating the stupa outside in the courtyard there to Dada Rinpoche, and not just evoking a sense of Dada Rinpoche's presence through that, but also our sense of connection, our sense of history and tradition. So it was particularly good to see Bhante sat right here in the Shrine Room on that occasion, to see a young Sarita sat just there meditating, and to see a young Padmavajra as well circumambulating the stupa as Bhante was putting the relics inside of it. So hopefully that already is giving us a sense of tradition and a sense of connection to Dada Rinpoche, and a sense of his presence. So obviously we're aware of Dada Rinpoche's presence at Padmaloka every day, in the sense that to come into here, to come into the Shrine Room, we have to go around his stupa, so we can bring Dada Rinpoche to mind quite easily here. But still, I think even for us living here, we need to evoke a sense of Dada Rinpoche's presence more and more fully, not just for the benefit that that brings in itself, but also because on this retreat we're about to study Dada Rinpoche's teaching, and to study his message to us: cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. And it's important when we do study somebody's teaching that we know where it's coming from, if you like, or who it's coming from. And some of you will know that in his lectures on the Bodhisattva ideal, Bhante starts that series, doesn't he, by talking about the importance not just of what the Buddha said, not just the importance of his teaching, but who the Buddha was, the importance of the man as well as the message. So on this retreat, while we're exploring the message of cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love, we need to have a sense of the man. We need to have a sense of who Dada Rinpoche was, where those words were coming from, what the inspiration was behind those words. So that's the purpose of this morning's session, is to really try to do that, to evoke Dada Rinpoche, the man. Okay, so I want to do that in a particular way as well. Rather than just give you a full kind of biographical sketch of Dada Rinpoche's life, if you want that, you can just get yourself a copy of Suvadra's book, The Wheel and the Diamond, and that will give you a full account of his life. I'm not going to do it quite like that. Instead, I want to explore, I guess, Dada Rinpoche's qualities through his life, but to do that specifically through the eyes of our own teacher. So do that specifically through Bhante's eyes and through their connection with each other. And I think the reason for that is similar to as I've just been saying about the importance of connection. So recognizing that with Dada Rinpoche, we do have an actual connection. We do have a living connection to him. And it's important to feel that connection, I think. So Dada Rinpoche comes from, if you like, old Tibet. He comes from Tibet before the Chinese invasion, before the diaspora into India. So really, he comes from another world. It's quite almost unimaginable what that world would have been like. And in many ways, it's a lost world now, of course. And there's something really good about that, and something quite attractive about that. But it also carries a danger for us as well. So the danger is that we can find it hard to connect with Dada Rinpoche because that world seems so foreign to us, so other to us. Or we do connect, but we connect perhaps in the wrong kind of way. So on the one hand, we might feel that, you know, we'll hear about Dada Rinpoche's practice shortly. We might hear that and we might think, well, you know, my practice is nowhere near that. It's nowhere near as intense as the things that he was doing every morning. Tibetan Buddhism is the real thing. What we do is just a pale, poor imitation of that. So we can get into that kind of mindset, I think, and feel a bit despondent or disheartened. I don't think we have to do that. The other extreme is that we find it all so impressive, so mysterious, so exotic. We're dazzled by everything. But we don't recognize that actually we can do that too. We can do that in our own particular way. And we're not just a devotee. We can also be a disciple. We can also put into practice the things that Dada Rinpoche was putting into practice in his own life. So we want to avoid both of those extremes and just see that there is that living connection. And of course, to use our own language, that connection boils down to going for refuge. So Dada Rinpoche is somebody who went for refuge. Bhante, his going for refuge was influenced by Dada Rinpoche's going for refuge. So our going for refuge, which we share an understanding of through Bhante, is connected with Dada Rinpoche's going for refuge. So that is the connection, that's the lineage, that we're part of a lineage of going for refuge. And I think by exploring his life through Bhante, we can get more and more of a feel for that. Okay, so let's start with a passage from Precious Teachers. This is one of the volumes of Bhante's memoirs. We had a reading from this already last night. This is a different one. And the context for this is Bhante receiving the Bodhisattva ordination from Dada Rinpoche. And in this short paragraph, he actually gives a very brief biographical sketch of Dada Rinpoche's life, at least his early life. So we'll just hear what Bhante has to say. It was not surprising that I should have received the ordination from Dada Rinpoche, whom I had known since 1952, and whom I had come to revere as a living bodhisattva. This was not to say that my other Tibetan teachers were not bodhisattvas, but I had known Dada Rinpoche longer than I had known any of them, had spent more time in his company, and in our odd mixture of Hindi, Tibetan, and English, I had a serviceable medium of communication, such as I did not have with any of them. He had never given me an outline of his biography, but from the conversations we had had over the years, I had come to know something about him. I knew that he had been born in Dart Sendo in eastern Tibet, that his father was a merchant, that at an early age he had entered Drepung Gompa, the great Gelug monastic university near Lhasa, that he had passed all his examinations with great credit, that his teacher was strict but kind, that a breakdown in his health had prevented him from completing his studies at the Tantric College, where the routine was demanding and conditions harsh, that in 1947, at the age of 29, he had come to India in search of health, and that on his return, after he had been back only 18 months, the Dalai Lama's government had appointed him abbot of the Tibetan monastery at Bodh Gaya, thus obliging him to make the long and arduous journey to India for the second time. So I'll just pause there and just pick up a couple of things. So Bhante says here that he'd come to revere Dada Rinpoche as a living bodhisattva. So that is strong language, isn't it? He'd come to revere him. So not just respect him or look up to him, but revere him. And also to revere him as a living bodhisattva. I don't think Bhante would say that lightly. I think he would have really weighed up his words before he would say something like that about somebody. So to say that Dado Rinpoche was a living bodhisattva is quite a statement, and quite a testament, I think, to how Bhante saw Dado Rinpoche's practice and the way that he lived his life. So obviously seeing him as somebody who exemplified the six paramitas of the bodhisattva path, someone who embodied those six paramitas, a high degree of wisdom and compassion. So that's the first thing. The second thing there, we got a sense of Dado Rinpoche's early life and the things, the conditions that led to him becoming obviously quite an exceptional individual. One of the things that Bhante didn't say there was even though he mentioned Dado Rinpoche being born in Dartsendo in 1917, he doesn't mention there that Dado Rinpoche was recognized as a tulku. So recognized or identified as being the 13th Dado tulku. So a tulku, if people aren't sure, is let's say an important lama who it's believed can direct their rebirth to a time and place where they'll continue the work of the previous incarnation of that particular tulku. So Dado Rinpoche was the 13th in this particular line of tulkus. And if you read Suvajra's book, you'll pick up that Dado Rinpoche as a child, I think at the age of about 3, would say things to his mother like, "I've got many monasteries and one day my servants are going to come and find me," and things like that. And eventually they did come and investigate that, and he picked out all the things that had belonged to him in the previous life. So he was recognized as the 13th Dado Tulku. I don't know what you guys make of all that. I have to say myself, since watching, some of us in the community have been watching this series on Netflix, of all places, called Surviving Death. And there's an episode in particular on rebirth, or on cases of supposed rebirth. And it's really got me thinking anyway that maybe there's more in that than I'd previously supposed, or I mean, it's easy to take that on board as a Buddhist teaching, but when you see it in this other context, mainly in America, it got me thinking anyway that I've probably not reflected enough on that, or been too dismissive in the past of that that kind of vision of life or attitude towards life. So I don't know what you guys make of that notion of Dado Rinpoche being a tulku. Dado Rinpoche himself said that even though he'd had those memories as a very young child, they faded as he grew older. So I think by the age of about 5 or 6, those memories had faded. He said he didn't feel like a tulku. He didn't feel that, but everybody treated him as if he was one. So he decided that he would act like one. And he'd act like a tulku by cultivating wisdom and compassion. And he used to say to people that visited him as well, "Well, you can be a Rinpoche. A Rinpoche is a greatly precious one. Well, you can be a greatly precious one. All you've got to do is act like one. You know, just cultivate wisdom and compassion, and we can all be Rinpoches." So very kind of practical, down-to-earth response to that notion of him being a great incarnate lama. Another point that we got from that passage from Bhante there was to do with Dado Rinpoche's training. So Bhante said that he entered the great monastery, the Drepung Gompa, at the age of 4. And I mean, reading again Suvajra's book, you get the impression it was a really formidable training. So even from the age of 4, Dado Rinpoche was meditating, learning to meditate, reciting every day the suttas, being taught to recite the suttas from memory, and entering into these debating competitions, which if you've ever seen them, they look really quite hardcore debates, don't they? Just Tibetan monks really going at it, talking about shunyata and testing each other, challenging each other's views, usually with kind of hand slaps, and you have to give an instant response. You're not allowed to hesitate or pause at all. You've got to have the Dharma kind of at your fingertips, so you can just come back at the other person. All in the context, of course, of metta and love and compassion and all the rest of it, not just competition for its own sake. So yeah, you do get the sense, particularly reading Suvajra's book, of a formidable training. And Bhante mentioned that Dada Rinpoche had said his teacher was strict but kind. And you also get a full account of Dada Rinpoche's relationship with his own teacher. So Yeshe Lundup was his first teacher. And these are the words of Dada Rinpoche himself, just recollecting his teacher. So I'll read you this. It says, "I remember my guru with great fondness, and I remember very clearly all of his words of advice, kindness, and instruction. In respect of my religious studies, he was really a great guru. When I remember and think of these things, my eyes well up with tears." So he obviously had great love, reverence for his teacher, who, as he described to Bhante, was very kind, but also very strict. And you get the other side of things in the biography as well, just how direct, how challenging his teacher could be. He wasn't shy of giving Dada Rinpoche a thrashing if he had acted unskillfully or unkindly to people. So it's a strange blend when you read about it, this kind of very disciplined, very strict approach to a young monk's education, and also just this great devotion and great love for the student as well. So something for us to hold perhaps difficultly, given modern views and outlooks and all the rest of it. But obviously a lot of devotion there, and that aspect of his training, the learning from somebody of Yeshe Lundup's quality, obviously influenced the rest of Dada Rinpoche's life. So he then went on to the Tantric College, as Bhante mentioned, but conditions there were very harsh indeed. So this would involve a lot of meditation every day. I believe that monks in Tantric colleges have to sleep in meditation posture. So they sleep seated up. They just have their over robe, single sheet. Bearing in mind, this is Tibet, up high in the mountains and freezing cold stone buildings, and they just had this one sheet wrapped around them. And that really took its toll on Dada Rinpoche's health. So he had to go off to India to seek some kind of cure. Did get better, but after briefly being back in Tibet, as Bhante says, he was posted to Bodh Gaya in 1949 to become the abbot of the monastery there. So Bhante crossed paths with Dada Rinpoche in 1949 in Bodh Gaya, and we heard that reading before the puja last night, where Dada Rinpoche just looks out the window, sees Bhante on the roof of the Mahabodhi guest house, and just exclaims, "Look, the Dharma's gone as far as the west, because there's this white guy in a yellow robe." And again, as he said in the reading, it wasn't until a few years later that they actually met. So in 1952, they met each other in Kalimpong, and Bhante went to see Dada Rinpoche about this dispute that had happened between him and a young Sinhalese monk in Bodh Gaya. And as we heard, Bhante, listening to Dada Rinpoche's account, realized that he could be at no way at fault for the dispute, given his, I can't remember the words now, but his integrity. Basically, Bhante was very impressed by that. I think just drawing out from that little episode, where obviously there was this dispute between him and this young Sinhalese monk in the early 50s, there was also tension between Dada Rinpoche and the monks of his own monastery at Bodh Gaya as well. You get more of an insight into this from Suvajra's book. Basically, Dada Rinpoche came in and became the abbot. He was younger than most of the monks, and he imposed quite a strict discipline on what had been happening before. I'll just read you a passage, actually, about that part of his life. So this is Suvadra talking about Dada Rinpoche's reflections on that tension in the monastery at Bodh Gaya. So at Drepung, that's where Dada Rinpoche trained, his teacher Yeshe Lunda had always impressed upon Dada Rinpoche the importance of adhering to the monastic code. And now that he was abbot of his own monastery, he was determined to run it in accordance with these ancient rules. The purpose of many of these had long since been forgotten, and others had come to be neglected or ignored. But Rinpoche took infinite pains to consult their canonical sources in order to understand how and why they had been instituted and how they might be interpreted in a manner which was in keeping with their spirit. But he insisted that those under him follow a strict regime. Geshe Jampal Tado, that's one of Dada Rinpoche's disciples, recalled that Rinpoche was always checking on the rules of the monastery, what pujas they did, what practices, and so forth. In the face of this, the monks were not easy. Most were over 30 and had been used to varying degrees of strictness. They found it difficult to repose trust in a young man of whom they knew little. Moreover, Rinpoche could be very outspoken, and the monastery was very small. In a frank discussion, he told me, "The main thing is that I was a strict disciplinarian and used to keep things under very strict control, which many of them disliked." So that's Rinpoche himself on what it was like in the monastery there at Bodh Gaya. And obviously he was a disciplinarian and imposed a particular order in the monastery, but not for its own sake. So not just for the exercise of power. I think this is a really important point. It's obvious that he was doing it for the sake of getting to the essence of what their life was actually about. So getting down to the essence of why they do certain practices, why they behave in certain ways, which seems to have just been forgotten or ignored by some of the other monks there in the monastery. And I couldn't help but be reminded reading that passage of Bhante and his description himself in his own memoirs of that time where he's at the ashram and he's just pacing up and down every day and asking himself, well, why did the Buddha teach this? You know, the three lakshanas, why did the Buddha teach those three particular marks of conditioned existence? What would have been the purpose of that? So there's something about that attitude that I think is one of great quality, of really asking oneself, well, why do we do things like this? What is the spiritual purpose, the spiritual significance of this or that practice? So I think you really get a sense of that from reading about Dada Rinpoche's life. In our language again, he was in touch with going for refuge, and that being the thing that was underpinning all these different practices and trying to draw that essence out. So in no way a career monk, not interested in status, very much an individual, and even willing to be unpopular amongst people that were upset by his adherence to the true spirit of things, rather than just slipping into what Bhante has described as the canker of monastic formalism. So we could see Dada Rinpoche as exemplifying the very opposite of the canker of religious formalism. And you get other moments in his life where that becomes, again, apparent. Or the things that made an impression on Dada Rinpoche, when you read about them, they all seem to have been in that area. You know, he was impressed by people who we might say were the real deal. And he tells a story in Suvadra's book of a time when he was a student himself at Drepung Gompa, and a lama came to give a teaching. And Dada Rinpoche was really impressed by this lama because he refused to accept the gifts of his disciples, so that the money that they were offering him to build different monasteries, he refused to accept it. And he said to them, the reason he was refusing to accept these gifts, firstly, it was because how did they know? Firstly, it was because he told them, if I'm a great lama, if I am a tulku, if I can choose to be reborn in a particular space and time, I don't need your money and your wealth. I'll just choose to be reborn into a wealthy family. He said, on the other hand, how do you know that I'm actually a great lama and that I will be able to do that? And if you can't be confident in that, you're going to give me all this money and then some other lucky little kid is going to get recognized as the new me and they'll inherit all that wealth that you've given. And that made a great impression, apparently, on Dada Rinpoche, that this lama was just applying logic to the situation. Just making the point that being a Buddhist is not about just the exchange of wealth or the accumulation of wealth. It's about much deeper principles than that. And of course, we can also see Dada Rinpoche's commitment to the true ideals of Buddhism from his own practice. So here we'll have the famous reading of Dada Rinpoche's daily routine. Let's see what you make of this if you haven't heard it before. So this is Dada Rinpoche's daily program at the time when Suvadra would have met him in the 80s. So Dada Rinpoche's daily program ran as follows. He regularly rose between 4 and 4:30 a.m. He washed and dressed while visualizing himself in the form of a deep blue bull-headed figure called Vajrabhairava, or Diamond Terror, the wrathful form of Manjushri, embodiment of wisdom. At the same time, he recited prayers of purification and repeated mantras. He continued to do this while cleaning his teeth, which consequently took him between 40 and 50 minutes. He then ate a light breakfast and sat for a period of formal meditation. This started with a systematic reflection on his purpose. Only when he was fully satisfied that he was not seeking blessings or personal merit would he proceed to the full practice. As a prelude to this, he engaged in an examination of any unskillful actions he had committed and made a ritual confession of them. In this purified state, he recited the traditional refuges and precepts, committing himself to the ideals of Buddhism and to the practice of ethics. He then visualized Tsongkhapa, the 14th century founder of his monastic sect, with his two main disciples, and recited a prayer on the three principles of the path. Here, he symbolically established all beings in a state of purity, by visualizing himself surrounded by an infinite host of beings and imagining them bathed in light which poured from his heart. Next, in what he called the main meditation of the morning, Rinpoche visualized two bodhisattvas in female form, White Tara, who is immaculate and radiant, seated in meditation posture, and Green Tara, who has one foot stepping down into the world. Rinpoche concluded his period of meditation by reciting all the mantras for which he might be called upon to give initiation. He also found half an hour every morning to do some gardening among the rows of potted plants at his rooftop. If there was any time left over, he would study until lunch. This was how he spent the first 6 hours of each day. Rinpoche regarded these hours of spiritual practice as the indispensable basis for the cultivation of the insight and compassion from which everything else in his life derived. So you can see that's quite a morning practice, isn't it? How to spend the first 6 hours of one's day. I suppose elements in there that we would recognize, so things like puja, guru yoga, in the sense of visualizing Tsongkhapa and his disciples, as well as sadhana, visualizing Tara in two different forms. So things that are not alien to us, but 6 hours worth every morning and not missing a day is quite a commitment, isn't it? Quite a practice to undertake. And no doubt it was that kind of dedication to practice that would have attracted Bhante. You could imagine, couldn't you, him having toured India for many years and not meeting very many Buddhists, to suddenly, well, not suddenly, but to encounter somebody of Dada Rinpoche's quality and calibre, it must have made a strong impression. And we heard Bhante last night saying that after their first meeting in 1952, a friendship developed between them. And it does seem to have been quite an unusual one, in the sense that there was the guru-disciple dynamic, to use that language. There was the fact that, Dada Rinpoche gave Bhante the Bodhisattva ordination and initiation into particular practices. But they do seem to have been friends as well. It wasn't overly formal. There was definitely another dimension to their relationship. And I guess for us, that might not seem unusual, just because of the culture that we're in and we experience ourselves. But I think it was quite unusual, going back to the 1950s and thinking in particular of Tibetan Buddhism and the etiquette and ceremony around one's teacher. I want to read you a quick passage. This is Dada Rinpoche on his friendship with Bhante, which gives another side of things, another interesting perspective, which shows that it wasn't, again, one way, but actually reciprocal. And you do get the sense of something very creative between the two of them, and mutually kind of sparking each other off and inspiring each other. So Dada Rinpoche said of Bhante, "When we talked about profound aspects of Buddhism, he," that's Bhante, "had no difficulty at all in understanding them, with ease. Not only this, but at the same time, he was able to put it all into practice and to teach others. Ordinary people cannot understand deep points of Dharma so easily and are not in a position to teach others. His high level of motivation and dedication to the study of Buddhism encouraged and inspired me to study Buddhism even more seriously and in even greater depth." Yeah, so you do get a sense from that of something reciprocal, something mutual, as I say, a kind of mutual sparking each other off. It reminded me of Bhante's description of communication with the within the Sangha, or the ideal of communication within the Sangha as a vital mutual responsiveness. So when two Dharma practitioners come together, both committed to the values of the Dharma, the value of the three jewels, and exploring together the spiritual world through communication, even transcending the distinction between self and other through that communication. So I do wonder to what extent Bhante's thinking in terms of this notion of vital mutual responsiveness was influenced by his connection with Dada Rinpoche. You do get the impression that they had that kind of quality of communication between them. Okay, so that friendship, that connection between Dada Rinpoche and Bhante, as he said, developed after 1952, so does grow and increase. You can read lovely accounts of them on a tour of India in a train together. I won't go into the quotations from that, but basically the government of India in 1956 organized a tour of the holy places and invited eminent Buddhists from different regions to inhabit this train for a time, where they would eat and they would sleep and they'd tour the different holy places. And Bhante and Dada Rinpoche shared a compartment on that particular occasion, and he said that it was on that trip that he really saw how adaptable Dada Rinpoche could be. So you can imagine a long journey in India is not going to be without its challenges and things not necessarily going to plan, and apparently Dada Rinpoche was just very adaptable and flexible to changing circumstances. He said he also saw his humility and how he didn't stand on ceremony. And also Dada Rinpoche's sense of humour, his sense of fun. You get the impression that Bhante really enjoyed his company and spending time with him on that particular trip. But Bhante said above all that the quality that stood out when they spent that time together was Dada Rinpoche's unfailing mindfulness. So nothing at all in the region of forgetfulness, and also, you know, incredibly mindful, and with a certain degree of foresight and preparedness. And the one story I will tell is the one you've probably heard before, where in the morning the due to visit this dam. So the government of India was also showing them different projects it had been involved in. So in the morning, visit a dam. In the afternoon, visit one of the holy places. And when they arrive in the morning and all get off the train and go so far, they realize that they're not at a dam, they're at the holy place, and there's been some kind of mix-up. So all of these monks are there. None of them have got any candles to offer. None of them have got any incense, except Dada Rinpoche, who opens up his robe and just pulls out bundles of candles and incense and starts distributing them for everybody to make offerings. And Bhante said after that occasion that Dada Rinpoche was never caught napping. So for our non-native speakers, Dada Rinpoche was always awake and alive to what was going on or what might happen. So they had this friendship, as I'm saying, but also a working connection as well, working for the good of Buddhism. I think Bhante used that phrase in the reading we had last night. So often that would involve translating together, working things out, appearing to give public talks at each other's events that they were organizing. But in terms of Dada Rinpoche's work for the good of Buddhism, we could say his main focus from 1954 right up until his death was the school that he founded. I'll read this passage from, this is another book, so A Celebration of Dada Rinpoche, which contains various people's recollections of meetings with him. But in the back, you've got a transcript of a talk that Bhante gave on the message of Dada Rinpoche. And I just really like the way he describes Rinpoche's devotion to the school that he founded. So I'll read this passage from Bhante's talk. So he says, Dada Rinpoche didn't write any books or give any lectures, and his discourses in Tibetan had not been preserved, but he did found a school. In 1954, he founded what he always used to call in full the Indo-Tibet Buddhist Cultural Institute School. I remember that he liked very much to pronounce these words in English on every possible occasion. He was very proud of his beloved Indo-Tibet Buddhist Cultural Institute School, which I am glad to say still exists. I think it's actually about to close, isn't it? We just had news of that. Not through mismanagement or lack of funds. It's more a case of having fulfilled its mission, I think. For 36 years, his life revolved, practically speaking, around it. It was really very dear to him. I can hardly express how dear. And he overcame tremendous obstacles to keep it going. On one occasion, he had even to sell off some of his precious and beautiful tankers to pay the wages of his teaching staff. He didn't love his school as an institution. He didn't love its bricks and stones, or rather its wooden boards, as originally it functioned in a big old wooden building. When I say that Rinpoche loved his school, what I mean is that he loved his pupils, thousands of whom must have passed through the school, passed under their care, over the years. And because Rinpoche loved his pupils so much, he dearly wanted them to grow up under the benign influence of the Dharma. He wanted them to grow up as real Buddhists. That is why the school day began for everybody with the chanting of the praises of the Buddha, as well as the praises of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and Sarasvati, the female Bodhisattva of learning and culture, invocation of whom is believed by the Tibetans, as by Indian Buddhists before them, to assist in the preservation of a good memory. That's why the pupils of his school studied, in addition to various modern subjects, the Tibetan language and Tibetan literature. And that's why Rinpoche gave his beloved pupils a message. And that message, of course, is the message that we're exploring on the retreat. So cherish the doctrine. Live united, radiate love was the motto of the Indo-Tibet Buddhist Cultural Institute school. So no doubt seeing Dada Rinpoche found the school and the devotion that he obviously had for the pupils there and the staff there as well, no doubt that played a part in impressing Bhante so much. And as we heard before, making him begin to revere Dada Rinpoche as a living Bodhisattva. And therefore, having seen that, been impressed by that, Bhante did ask Dada Rinpoche to give him the Bodhisattva ordination, as we've heard already, in 1962. So he gave him the ordination in 1962, and apparently went through the different precepts that Bhante was taking on, the 18 major and 46 minor precepts of the Bodhisattva, of the novice Bodhisattva. So definitely from that point onwards, Bhante would have regarded him very much as his teacher. It wasn't long after that Bhante returned to the West. So in 1964, he decided to go back to the West. And it was at the invitation, wasn't it, either of the English Sangha Trust or the British Buddhist Society, if I've got that right. And he didn't plan to stay long term, but, you know, 6 months turned into a year, etc., etc. And Bhante realized that actually he would stay in the West, and went back to India in 1967 to say farewell to his teachers and his disciples. And he met and spent time with Dada Rinpoche at that time. And it sounds like from reading again in Suvajra's book that Dada Rinpoche was quite instrumental actually in encouraging Bhante to move to the West and make that his permanent base. I think Bhante was quite happy actually before coming back to the West, being in India, and saw himself as going to be there for the rest of his life. But Dada Rinpoche encouraged him. He said, you could be far more effective in the West than I could. He even said to Bhante, you could be far more effective in the West than 100 Tibetan lamas, because you're a Westerner, you know that language, you know the culture, you can communicate the Dharma there most effectively and succeed. And of course, as we know, Bhante did succeed in that mission and founded the order not long after his departure from India. So 1968, the order's founded. Not long after that, a good number of order members around. And after that point, the connection that we've been exploring here between Dada Rinpoche and Bhante, obviously that broadens out. It becomes bigger than just the two of them. So order members in the early 70s did begin to connect and form direct connections with Dada Rinpoche for themselves, including Surita and Padmavajra here. So I think Surita and Loka Mitra, I'd have to check this, but I think they were the first two order members to meet with Dada Rinpoche, or go and find him and meet with him. I think Bhante had said, oh, go and see Dada Rinpoche and see how he is. And Padmavajra tells the story of meeting him a bit later on as well. And a lovely detail to his story is how he showed Dada Rinpoche some photographs of Bhante and other pictures. I think a little green Tara image that he had. And he said Dada Rinpoche just treated them like the most sacred objects when Padmavajra put them in his hands, making kind of noises. And, ooh, ooh. A lovely story. You have to ask Padmavajra to give a talk on this sometime and share that. As I'm saying, this connection between Bhante and Dada Rinpoche blossoms, if you like, broadens out, becomes a connection between Dada Rinpoche and the order as a whole. And Dada Rinpoche said he didn't make any distinction between the disciples of Sangharakshita and his own disciples. You know, very much saw order members as being in his lineage, if you like, or as I've said, having a resonance with the way he understood the Dharma, the way he went for refuge. And order members very inspired by the project of the school in India, and began to fundraise for the school. And I think it was the Karanar Trust, the kind of origins of the Karanar Trust came out of that engagement with the school of Dada Rinpoche. And fundraising was done. The future of the school was secured, because it had always been very precarious, I think, until that point. And I believe that gave Dada Rinpoche great kind of relief in his last years, to know that the funds for the school were on a good footing. And that's our living connection, isn't it? So as I say, through Bhante, we are in a sense direct contact with the influence or the Adhisthana, the blessings of Dada Rinpoche. It is a living connection that we have. It's not something that we're separate from, that belongs only to that old world of Tibet. It's not something that was lost at the time of Dada Rinpoche's death or Bante's death. It lives, and I think our retreat now is testimony to that living spirit and that living connection that we have with him. So I'll just finish. We're just coming up to 1 o'clock, so I'll finish soon. But just a few words about Dada Rinpoche's last months, just to come to a conclusion. So I once heard it said that you can tell a lot about a man and how he's lived his life by how he prepares for death, or words to that effect. And I think we've got an amazing example of that here in Dada Rinpoche. So if you guys have read Suvadra's biography, you'll know the story and know how impressive it is. I can't do it justice in the time we've got left, but just very briefly, in 1989, I think it was the year before Dada Rinpoche died, an order member had a dream in which he saw Dada Rinpoche in the sky and many suns eclipsed and scorpions in the sky. And was encouraged to tell this to Dada Rinpoche, who took it very seriously, saw it as a so-called big dream, and thought that the signs were inauspicious. The signs in the dream were inauspicious, given that he was, I think, 73 and not in particularly good health. So he began to see the signs of death, I suppose, from that time onwards, and decided to go on a pilgrimage to Nepal, which I think had been a long-running ambition of his, to go and visit the holy places in Nepal. And I will just push the time, if you don't mind, and read from Suvadra's book, because it is really quite remarkable. This is a description of Dada Rinpoche on pilgrimage. So Rinpoche set off in January 1990, attended by Jampal Kalden, with his wife, two sons and two daughters, and a grandchild. In Kathmandu, Gangchen Rinpoche generously supplied the party with a jeep, two monks to act as guides, and food for the month-long journey. There had been plans for Rinpoche to spend a month at Gangchen Rinpoche's monastery in Kathmandu in order to deliver teachings and initiations to the monks, but the astrological portents were unfavourable, and he arrived in Kathmandu later than he'd hoped. There were nevertheless reception meals in various supporters' houses, blessings to be imparted, temples to be visited, and teachings to be expounded at Gangchen Rinpoche's monastery. But after just a few days, the party set off across Nepal. The journey lasted a full month, during which time Dada Rinpoche took only a few hours' rest. The party visited the great Buddhist stupas of Bauda and Swayamabhu, pardon for that. As he travelled, he gave money to provide new coats of whitewash for the monuments. A number of Gelugpa monasteries were given money to repaint their facades, and he made a small donation to every monk. Each beggar who approached was also given something. Eventually, Wang Po, one of Jampal Kalden's sons, piped up, "Rinpoche, you can't give to every beggar. How many are there in the world?" But Rinpoche replied, "You don't know what I'm doing. Just let me give." And it goes on. So it's quite remarkable how at that age and in failing health, he's giving so much, not just materially, giving money, giving to the monks, giving to the monasteries, but giving the Dharma, giving his time, giving his energy, in that way as well, communicating very fully and thoroughly. So very impressive. But sadly, it wasn't long after his return to Kalimpong that Rinpoche suffered a stroke and was debilitated by that for some time. He did make a kind of recovery, but again, not long afterwards, his health began to fail more and more. And again, he just goes into a particular mode by the sounds of it, where he's realizing what's happening and just thoroughly prepares. You know, all that practice that we've heard about and discipline It doesn't go anywhere in death. In fact, it sounds like it intensifies. So he brought all his tankas and images into one space, would perform special pujas for the dead, I think every evening by the sounds of it. And then the evening came where, again, he was performing his puja as he had been doing, but he was also keen to write letters, give instructions, make sure that people had the right information and the messages that they'd need in his absence. And after doing more puja, more chanting, those closest to him, those around him, found that he'd slipped away. So that was 24th of March at 1990. So obviously the anniversary for that's just how many days away? 11 days away, which is why obviously we're exploring this theme at this time of year. And we've done it in the past at Padmaloka as well. We're remembering Dada Rinpoche's extraordinary life on this retreat. But let's do that every year in March, every year. Let's remember this remarkable individual, this remarkable man, and his message. So as I said at the beginning, we will be exploring the message during this retreat. And let's do that really fully. Let's do that as the man himself would have done that. So really explore these words in the motto, cherishing the doctrine, live united, radiate love. What do they really mean? You know, let's really go into that very, very thoroughly and fully. And if we do that, we'll be following, I think, very well in the footsteps of Dada Rinpoche.